This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's Halloween, so today we spend time talking about mysterious things. Later in the program, WFAE Sarah D'Elia talks to the host of the hit podcast Lore, as well as the producer of the Amazon TV show of the same name, about ghost stories and folk tales and their origins. But first, we look at conspiracy theories. Last week's release of documents surrounding the Kennedy assassination that had been under lock and key for 50 years reignited some dormant conspiracy theories surrounding that tragic event. A survey that came out this month found that despite the Warren Commission report, countless other research papers and books about the assassination, 60% of Americans still believe it was the result of a conspiracy. But conspiracies about who really killed Kennedy aren't the only ones floating around. There are people who believe the moon landings were faked. The 9/11 attacks have also elicited skeptics doubting the official version of events. But why? Where do these theories come from? Why do some find them not only plausible, but more believable than what officials say are the facts? To talk about that, we've invited David Bollinger and Marshall Brain to join us. David is professor of communication studies at UNC Wilmington. He joins us from the studios of WHQR in that city. Welcome to the program, David.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Marshall Brain is back with us. He's the founder of How Stuff Works and the director of the NC State University Engineering Entrepreneurship Program. Marshall, welcome back.
Good morning.
Good morning. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Well, David, you teach a course in conspiracy theory at UNC Wilmington, and I'm curious as to what that entails. Give me the course catalog description.
Well, it's in the honors program. I'm in the honors faculty, and I've been doing this about every fall for the last few years. I teach a three-hour course called The Rhetoric of Conspiracy, and it focuses on looking at the mechanisms in terms of rhetoric and communication and how conspiracies are created, formed, where they come from. And then I teach the students how to look at different kinds of conspiracy and then do an analysis of them. And they do this, they write a big research paper, and at the end of the semester, they do a presentation. And the nature of exploring the conspiracy, what I do is I allow them to choose the conspiracy theory that they would like to look at. So I get a variety. I get some people looking at some of the classics like JFK. 9/11 is a classic now. And then some of them have a lot of fun doing like Mars stuff, you know, and aliens. And you got your reptilians and everything.
Are they – that's a new one on me. I read yesterday that there are a lot of people out there who believe that the real leaders of the world – are reptiles.
I mean, yeah.
Disguised as humans, and that's like out of the TV show V.
Yeah. It's an old theme. It's that's what I call hitting. For me, that's hitting the wall.
So the young people who come to you to take that class, are they taking that class because they themselves harbor conspiracy theories of their own, and that's why it interests them? And if so, do they change their minds by the end of the course?
Well, what they have to do, first of all, they're honor students, so they're required to take a certain number of hours, and then they have to write a thesis. Mm-hmm. And they're all different majors, too, by the way. Mm-hmm. I think over the years, the popularity of the course, I have absolutely no problems getting seats, you know, filled. And so the word of mouth has been kind of, you know, helpful there. But also, I think that there's a general kind of curiosity about a lot of this stuff. And yes, I think there are a couple of students that do come in that are already preloaded, you know, but not that many. But, you know, there are a couple of them that are just definitely chomping at the bit, ready to get started on their research.
So, Marshall Brain, you dissected conspiracy theories for How Stuff Works with a focus on the conspiracy theories, I believe, surrounding 9/11. Given that 50% of the country subscribes to at least one conspiracy theory and that 19% of Americans believe the government was behind 9/11, how do these theories work? How do these things get started?
So we first have to understand that human beings are the most fascinating species ever. So a lot of this goes back to that kind of root thing about human beings. But I think either they get started because a person has an agenda and they're going to fit everything into their agenda. And that might be true, like, you know, the Las Vegas shooting happened at the beginning of October, and there are people who have the government are going to take our guns agenda. And so immediately there were conspiracy theories around the Las Vegas event. Mm. The other way you get into it, I think, is because you look at something and there's a piece of it that doesn't make sense to you. And so you look at that piece, and since it doesn't make sense, then you try to form a picture around that, and that eventually grows to a full conspiracy theory. So in the case of 9/11, you might have looked at the way Building 7 fell and say, well, that makes no sense. And therefore, you know, and then you expand out from there. Or JFK, you know, there's no way that someone 300 feet away with iron sights was able to make a headshot on a moving target. Mm. So, you know, so you start with a little thing like that, and then it expands out from that core. I think those are the two big ways.
I'm wondering if we are, as Americans, particularly susceptible to this. Chapman University took a survey of American fears, which include questions about the levels of belief in 9 popular conspiracy theories. I don't know where Chapman University is or how valid this survey is, but 54% of Americans agree or strongly agree that the 9/11 attacks, the real cause, were being concealed by the government. 49% believe the government's concealing what they know about the JFK assassination. 42% about alien encounters. 42% about global warming. 32% about plans for one world government, and on and on and on. And it seems to cross all socioeconomic categories, because it says here the following are the personal characteristics that are significantly associated with higher numbers of conspiracy beliefs. If you are married, if you're a biblical literist, if you're a non-Judeo-Christian religion believer, if you're a Catholic, if you're employed, if you're cohabiting, if you're divorced or separated, if you're Republican, it's everybody. It's everybody. So are we more susceptible to this in this country than other countries?
Well, I get a fair number of international students, and they talk about it pretty openly too. So, I mean, that's just the snapshot I have, you know, in terms of international students. I would like to add one thing to what Marshall said about how these things work, because I always break it down like this. First of all, there's an event. Something happens, right? Mm-hmm. It's usually bad for most purposes. There's an event, and it's usually pretty big. Then authority figures, whatever they are, whoever they are, get in front of it and try to explain it. And they explain it from the perspective as an authority figure. So then they say, okay, here's our explanation. Now go home. The problem is their explanations have holes in them. And then other people who are asking, you know, what Marshall said, some people have agendas. That's definitely true. But some people are asking, you know, clear and intelligent and meaningful questions. Right. And they're not getting the answers. I have a colleague at work. He did his dissertation on the JFK assassination. And he and I were talking about this the other day in the Warren Commission. Gerald Ford was on that commission. It was supposed to be a secret closed commission. And he would regularly go to Hoover and leak information about what they were finding about what the FBI was doing and what they weren't doing. So that lends credence to the idea that, you know, as Americans, we weren't getting the full skinny on what was happening just with JFK. And ever since then, it's, you know, it just keeps on going, because I guess authority figures, you know, are just doing a crappy job.
I'm told by one of my producers, Chris Miller, that the Chapman University is in California. They do this survey every year, and that it is a credible study. Let's talk about the Kennedy assassination, because a lot of people who are my age and older, maybe perhaps a little younger, baby boomers, etc., have a lot of different theories about the Kennedy assassination. It was a major experience in their lives. You have said, David, that conspiracy theories come from things for which there are no answer. But when it comes to the Kennedy assassination and also to 9/11, we do seem to have those answers, don't we?
No.
Okay.
I think there's a willingness and an interest, especially just speaking as an American, that you want to believe that the authority figures have your back. And you guys ever watch that show on Netflix, Stranger Things?
I have not.
No. Okay. Well, there's a funny line in there in the first season where, you know, there are these government people that are doing bad experiments and stuff. And so there's a family, a regular American family, and this is based in the early 80s. And the father is saying to the wife as the agents are ransacking their house, well, this is the government and they have their best interest for us. And I think that there are a lot of people that over time, and this has been cumulative, you know, a lot of things have happened historically that have just eroded this confidence. There's an erosion, not just in that, but also in things based on like technology, for example. You know, people won't believe a photograph anymore, for example. You know, so it's a lot of different moving parts here.
Well, can you trace it back, Marshall or David? Can you trace this lack of trust, this degradation in trust of authority figures to the Kennedy assassination? Because that happened at a time when not only did the President of the United States was he shot and killed, but then you had the Vietnam War going on and a lot of fomenting of distrust of authority figures as a result of that. Can you trace it back to that time period, or does it predate that?
I think that's my starting point. I'm 58 years old, and I remember I was 4 years old when Kennedy was assassinated. But you could cut it with a knife, and you could see my father, who was in his 30s at the time, who was an Episcopal priest. He was very optimistic. He was really looking forward to what was going to happen in the future, and it was a kick in the gut. And then growing up during the 60s, again, you could cut it with a knife, and there's this sort of atmosphere that kind of comes and goes, and as events begin to happen that are bad, you know, like I said before, and authority figures they do a crappy job explaining it. Okay, then people are going to raise questions. But Marshall's right as far as people with agendas. As soon as the Las Vegas shootings happened, the first thing I did was, okay, let's see how long this takes. And Marshall, I think it took about, what, five or 10 seconds, and then they're coming to get our guns.
Is part of the problem also, Marshall, with that incident in Las Vegas, the fact now what is emerging is a disputed timeline of events, and with the sheriff's department saying one thing and journalists pasting together things from various video occurrences on people's camera phones that don't line up. So therefore, something's being hidden. Is that what's going on here?
Right. That is it. Feels like something's being hidden because it seems like in this day and age, they should be able to lay out all the evidence on a website or something. And you can just look and see, oh, this is true and this is true and this is true. And it all just is out there. But that doesn't happen. So, David, let me ask you, have you heard the idea that when the guard came up to the hallway, 200 shots through the door were aimed down the hallway? I hear the music.
Yes, you do. So we'll it'll be a cliffhanger. We'll come back. We'll get an answer to that and more in a second. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and NC Warren presenting Clean Path 2025, a strategy to slow climate change, save money, and create jobs with local solar power and battery storage. NCWarren.org. And Leland Little Auctions presenting the single owner collection of the late Keith and Caroline Gray of Charlotte, North Carolina, noted collectors, appraisers, and community members. Saturday, November the 4th, LelandLittle.com. Well, for women, the climb to the executive suite has been slow and difficult. Despite more women than men getting college degrees, women continue to be underrepresented at every level of the corporate pipeline. Women are hired and promoted at a lower rate than men, and the gap is more pronounced at the top. So we're going to take a look at how Charlotte and the rest of the state stack up against the rest of the nation and hear about efforts for change tomorrow on this program at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, the first indictments in the Russia investigation. Former Trump campaign chairman Paul Manafort and an associate surrendered to the FBI. We'll look at what it means. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
Stay tuned for that conversation on Point from 10 till noon, following Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins, here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about conspiracy theories, how they start, etc., with David Bollinger, professor of communication studies at UNC Wilmington. He joins us from the studios of WHQR there. And Marshall Brain, founder of How Stuff Works, director of engineering entrepreneurship program at NC State University. He joins us via Skype. So Marshall posed a question to you, David. Have you heard about the theory about the 200 rounds being fired into the hallway at that shooting in Las Vegas? I'm not sure what kind of a conspiracy that ties to, but Marshall, you might want to elaborate on that before David answers.
All right, 1 second of elaboration. It's a fact that is out there. You can go look it up on the internet, and you can see it was reported that 200 shots were fired down the hallway. So that seems like it should be easy to say that's either true or it's false. And here are the pictures that prove it happened. You know, you'd see a door with 200 holes in it, right? And the hallway would be totally sprayed with bullets. Or they would say, no, this isn't true, and we'd be done with it. So before the break, it was the authorities are leaving holes, and the evidence is up in the air, and this is how these things breed. And this is, to me, a good example of just one tiny element of the Las Vegas event.
Yeah. What I have heard, I've heard similar things, but including was he actually alone in the room, you know, that sort of thing. Did he have handlers there, which goes back to the whole Montauk mind control stuff, you know, that's been around forever. Once authority figures start making mistakes, I mean, I'm willing to give an authority figure the benefit of the doubt that in the heat of battle or whatever you want to call it, they're gonna screw up, and I can get that. The problem is they need to get in front of that as soon as they realize they make a mistake and say we made a mistake. That's not what we thought it was, but nobody's doing that. So then, as I think Marshall will agree, that's where some people with agendas will start making stuff up. And it kind of goes back to people who are hardcore agenda people are going to look at a photograph, Marshall, of a door that's shot up, and they're going to say that was Photoshop.
How much of this comes from the fact that we're talking about the Kennedy assassination, we've moved on to the Las Vegas shootings, that these are horrific events.
Right.
In the case of the Kennedy assassination, it really changed people's worldview. America lost its innocence that day in more ways than one.
Yes.
And then you have this latest shooting, which is just another example of a series of these shootings. And people just cannot wrap their heads around, A, that one person could be responsible for something like this. So it has to be a conspiracy theory, or that they simply don't want to live in a world that is so uncontrollable. How much of it is that?
Marshall?
I like the despair that something like Las Vegas or 9/11 causes certainly triggers a set of emotions that takes people in a lot of different directions, from we're going to bomb the Middle East to, you know, I don't want to live on this planet anymore. So it is going way back to the beginning. Humans are fascinating, and we respond to tragedy in a variety of ways. And conspiracy theories can help maybe assuage some of that or divert it or make the world a little more understandable.
Well, that's completely understandable in situations like 9/11, in situations like the Las Vegas shooting, about the Kennedy assassination, because these are horrific events and earth-shattering events. But the moon landings, that didn't hurt anybody. That didn't hurt anyone. And yet there are people who just don't believe that they took place, that they were staged on a Hollywood soundstage, and the government is pulling a fast one. Why?
Well, I've been to the moon, and I'm here to tell you that it's.
I want to go to the moon. Wait,
Marshall, you should check it out. Man.
One of these days, Alice, pal.
Oh yeah, Ralph Cramden was there. That's right. No, the I'm not really sure what to think about some of that stuff, because one of the things I was talking to your producer about earlier was that some people look at conspiracy theory also just as a source of entertainment, right? You know, we like spooky stuff. Today's Halloween, right? So we like aliens and we like, you know, reptilians, and we like all the spooky stuff that you can read about on some of these repositories of different websites from all over the world, like Inicio Biblioteca Pleiades is this big repository that has servers in Iceland and Italy, I think, or something. And you can go there and just read about all this crazy stuff and have a ball. And it's fun and it's entertaining. And then you get to the stuff that's real, like 9/11, right? Mm-hmm. Or Las Vegas, and it's not entertainment.
Well, you know, in the case of 9/11, and people have written about this, you've talked about it, David, I believe. Marshall, you've done it as well. But the fact that people don't believe that these airplanes could possibly have brought down these two towers, because that's not how towers come down. It looks like they were imploded from inside. And if you look at the videotape, they say, of these towers coming down, there's no question that they came down because we saw it live on television. But you can see, they say, the charges going off in the lower levels of the building below where the jetliners hit. And the fact that the lumbering jetliner could hit the Pentagon without being deterred, the most secure city in the world and the most secure building in the world, and yet this airliner allegedly hit this building. Not possible. Couldn't have happened. Why didn't fighter planes shoot all these other planes down? And you say, David, that people are so convinced that this didn't happen that people are sometimes willing to risk their credentials when it comes to what they believe.
Well, you know, and to me, when I do research on a conspiracy theory artifact, you know, one of the things I have to look at is credibility or ethos. And recently, well, a year ago, on the 9/11 anniversary, an engineer and I think a physicist and an architect co-released a paper, and they just basically said, based on our training, we should know that the towers fell based on controlled implosions. And they didn't speculate as to why somebody would do such a thing. They just simply said when they fell like they were being controlled demolition.
So when you hear things like that from people who know what they're talking about, do you think
are
they crazy or
no.
or what?
No, because I mean, when you're willing to stick your neck out and you put your name on the paper and your credentials and you're a real live person, and these guys even had, I think, their facial photographs on there. To me, that's like okay, you know. I mean, if you're willing to do that, then that tells me something. Now, is it true? Is it all nailed down? Well, no, we don't know that for sure, but. It's there, you know. So what I always look for is when somebody says, "Well, I have a source that told me this, but I can't tell you who they are because you know they're going to get bumped off." Then that's when I go, "Sorry."
And Marshall, a lot of these different conspiracy theories, the people who are really believers in this do a lot of homework. They do a lot of research. They write papers on it. They present their evidence. And a lot of it looks, on the surface, to be justifiable. How much of it turns out to be justifiable and just maybe a coincidental? But it could have happened this way, but just coincidentally it did not happen this way.
Well, I think we have to look at the profit motive in here at least a little bit.
Yes.
Because my first interaction with this was the book Chariot of the Gods. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember
that
book.
Oh, yes.
Right?
Was that Von Daniken?
Yes, I think it's Von somebody.
Yeah. I remember reading that and just being fascinated. Like, it was an amazing book because he took a whole bunch of stuff and he compiled it together into a compelling story. In the case of 9/11, the documentary Loose Change was the thing that compiled everything together into a coherent story. The moon landings, there are people who made a ton of money off of that conspiracy theory. So if you can wrap it up in a good story and push it out there, you can make a ton of money with a conspiracy theory.
I would think social media and fake news purveyors are making this even worse and more believable to a lot of people, these conspiracy theories. What about conversations like the one we're having right now, even considering these things? Does that further cement their authenticity?
No.
Okay.
I think, or in my opinion, no. What we have to do is unpack all these things first. And the only way we're going to be able to do that is by having meaningful conversations and saying the things that you want to say, you know, and then getting everything out on the table. And then we kind of deconstruct it and we look at it and we make our conclusions. Now, when we do that, we're still bringing our own. As Marshall pointed out, everybody has an agenda. It might be, you know, it might go one way, it might go the other, but we're all looking for answers. You know, we're all looking for things to try to wrap things together.
Have conspiracy theories ever been proven to be right?
What do you think, Marshall?
The Earth is not flat. Okay. So that one's out.
You're sure?
Are you sure? Are you sure?
I am positive on that one. So I don't – that's a great question, and I know we're bumping up against the wall here.
Yep, we are.
Yeah, we are.
Real quick,
a book that you guys should check out is called The Holographic Universe. It's been out since like 90.
Mm-hmm.
It's written by a physicist. I think his name is Bohm, B-O-H-M, I think, or something. It's a good read to look at the flat Earth thing.
And the name of the book quickly is?
The Holographic Universe.
Okay. David Bollinger, professor of communication studies, UNC Wilmington, and Marshall Brain, founder of How Stuff Works from NC State University. I think you were here. I believe you were here. Thank you for joining us. Aaron Mankey knows that truth is often stranger and scarier than fiction. His hit podcast, Lore, uncovers how horror stories and folklore full of dark figures like vampires, witches, and werewolves are actually rooted in real-life events. A little bit history and a little bit campfire storytelling, the award-winning podcast has found quite a following. It consistently tops the charts on iTunes and has been hailed by critics as one of the best history podcasts. And now it's been turned into a television series on Amazon with the help of the producers from The Walking Dead and The X-Files. Just in time for Halloween and ahead of his visit to Charlotte this week, WFAE's Sarah D'Elia spoke with him about the world of lore he's created and the rich tradition of folklore that has stuck around since America's early days.
Settlers up and down the East Coast of what would one day become America came ashore with heads full of superstitions and a propensity to attach meaning to things we might overlook today. They came with minds that were perfectly wired to build new folklore on the backs of old tales. New fears, new legends, new hauntings. And we can still find those creations in many places along the eastern seaboard. Places like North Carolina. Before the vacation homes and sun-baked tourists crowded along the sandy shores of the Outer Banks, pioneers were attempting to carve out an existence there. Those that survived left behind more than buildings and descendants, though. Today, the Outer Bank is home to tales that still send shivers down the spines of locals and tourists alike. Because folklore, whether it's new or old, has a way of leaving its mark. I'm Aaron Mankey, and this is Lore.
You're looking into stories that are hundreds of years old. What's the research process like?
Every episode is different. Some topics are more global in nature. And so, you know, the research process is a lot more scattered and multifaceted, you know, where I'm picking up books by people who are experts in the field or, you know, journals. But then, you know, I do an episode like a recent one called Wide Open about, you know, a local incident that happened. And that one, you know, it's just more local newspaper clippings and the few books that have picked up the story and dug deep into it.
It was one of those cool September nights that makes you think of campfires and dry leaves,
but the man couldn't see any of that. It was the middle of the night, and he was returning from an out-of-town business trip. Ulysses Griffith sold farm equipment in the surrounding community, and it kept him very busy, even by 1903 standards. As he was passing through town, exhausted and ready to climb into bed after such a long day, he studied the small village he called home. I think we've all done this before, when we're given the chance to see our community through a new lens, while all the hustle and bustle is asleep and the lights have all flickered out. Griffith was probably reveling in it. And that's when he saw something out of the corner of his eye. It was dark out. The moon was only a quarter full, after all, but he swore he saw a shape moving on one of the nearby rooftops. He turned to look, expecting it to vanish, but no, there was something out there, climbing from building to building like an animal. An animal with a light. At least, that's what he thought.
Every time it's a new adventure, it's a little bit of variety, which is nice. You know, I don't have to... It's not, there's no rut that I'm in. It's just, okay, this topic kind of means that I need to go this way with it. So I dig in. The research process typically begins with me handing the topic's name and maybe a theme that I'm guessing at and handing it to a research assistant. And I let them go out and find me all the source material and outline the, whether it's the events or a bio or whatever, they outline it out for me. And what that does for me is it, I've got a very distractible brain. So if I was to sit down and do all of that, I'd go down 100 rabbit trails and I would never get anything done. So I let a research assistant do it. And then they come back to me with all of those pieces. And that's where I start. I read all the sources. I read the outline. I go deep. And then once it's in my head, my brain just kind of takes over and starts putting the outline for the story together.
On the surface, your podcast is you, your voice, and some kind of creepy, well-thought-out music. But of course, there's more to it than that. There's a great amount of research that goes into it. And your writing just kind of sucks people in. You've said, I've read in other interviews, that you didn't, you know, set out to make this podcast, but it's turned out to be such a hit. Why do you think people are obsessed with this podcast?
You know, there is that deceptively simple nature of it, right? I mean, it's just, like you said, it's just me talking over a music bed. And I think because of that, maybe there's a bit less, you know, friction to get it in your head. There's no multiple talking heads you have to wrap your mind around. Who's talking now? Who is that? You know, there's no rambling discussion. It's a really focused story. I mean, it's almost like an audiobook, right? It's this pre-written historical essay that has a little bit more of a conversational tone. I'm kind of making it up as I go along, so I don't know if I've ever been able to boil down exactly what it is that makes the show so popular. That's kind of frustrating too, because if I ever had another show, I wouldn't be able to replicate it. But I also think that there's something to be said for just unanswered questions and mysteries, you know, that people like these stories because they don't pretend to have all the answers. And sometimes I think it's okay to have that. And I think some people actually seek out a little bit of mystery in their life.
More of Sarah D'Elia's interview with Aaron Menke, creator of the hit podcast Lore, in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Crescent Communities, presenting Lake James, a lakeside community at the base of the Blue Ridge Mountains, offering a new phase of home sites for custom home building. Details on offerings at lakejames.com. And Bradley, a full-service law firm serving the franchise industry in Charlotte and across the nation, partnering with clients to achieve their strategic business goals. Details at bradley.com. Indictments and a guilty plea send the Russia investigation into a new phase and signaled the probe is far from over. The White House, though, insists otherwise, that the investigation is near an end. There's still a question of whether the president will fire the special prosecutor. Just some of the things swirling around Washington, D.C., and some of the things they'll be talking about in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point with Tom Ashbrook. And Sarah D'Elia continues her conversation about Lore in a moment.
All Things Considered on WFAE helps you go beneath the surface of the day's news.
The legislature itself is not bound by this decree, is not party to the decree, even though they were defendants in the lawsuit. And if I were a judge, that would give me a pause about exactly how stable this really is.
There's more to every story. Listen weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 for All Things Considered from NPR News and 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Let's get back to Sarah D'Elia's conversation with Aaron Menke. He's the creator and host of the hit podcast Lore, which reveals the dark historical tales behind many of our modern-day superstitions. Lore has now been made into a television show on Amazon.
Throughout history, fear was best kept buried, sealed, closed. But folklore has a way of keeping the door open wide, allowing stories to live and breathe, to creep inside and haunt us. I'm Aaron Menke. This is Lore.
Have you always been into scary stories?
Yeah, I can trace a lot of it back to fifth grade. I don't know how much further back it goes than that. A couple of things happened in fifth grade. I was 10. My reading teacher sent us home with one of those Scholastic Readers Club catalogs, the little, you know, letter-sized newsprint, full-color things where you can buy books in. And I remember seeing a book in there. I don't remember who the author was or, you know, what it was called, but it was essentially a collection of weird but true tales, things that were supposed to have happened in the past, but were really, really on that edge of, could this have happened? You know, I convinced my parents to buy it for me and fell in love. Those stories just... it's like they flipped a switch inside my head and I've never looked back. And then it was later that year, that must have been at the beginning of the school year. And I think looking back on how it all kind of unfolded, I think maybe that catalog itself had some Halloween merchandise in it because Halloween was coming up. And then I got the book and my teacher, the same teacher, assigned us a short story for Halloween to work on our handwriting. Actually, it was a cursive assignment. She called it Chicken Scratch and wanted us to get better. So I wrote a story about a family in a pumpkin patch, and it was, it was my first attempt at writing a scary story, and I really, really enjoyed it. And I think after that, it was just a matter of every chance I had, I was writing something.
Well, most of the stories that you tell look at the worst in humanity, from people being buried alive to lobotomies and murders. How does that affect the way that you see the world? Do you see it through less than rosy colored glasses?
Yeah, it's it's kind of like talk to somebody who works at the CDC and how they view experiences at like an airport bathroom. You know, they have a unique perspective on it, and I'm not a fully trained cultural anthropologist or a psychologist. I mean, all of this is armchair activity for me. I'm just learning as I go. But you can't read stories that are part of our folklore tradition and not walk away thinking, if this is a thing we've passed down from generation to generation, or if this is a thing that happened in the past, what does it say about us? I think you have to do that. I think that collections of tales, whether they're audio or in print or whatnot, that explore the weird things just to explore them, are missing half the picture, right? Because people tell these stories, and whether they're true or not, the story comes out of that person and it's a reflection of who they are. Or maybe we're talking about events that happened and we see what people have done in the past, and it really does make you a little more wary of, you know, having faith in the people around us today to make wise choices.
Yeah.
A good example is a couple of weeks ago, one of the episodes was number 70, called Familiar. It's about a man in the 1600s in England around the time of the English Civil War who kind of assigns himself the title of Witchfinder General. And he, for a year and a half, he travels all over the south of England, rounding up people suspected of witchcraft and having them executed. And you know, he's responsible for half of the deaths connected with that in England for three centuries. And he did it all in a year and a half. I mean, he was quite prolific. And it was a job fueled by hatred of others, you know, people they don't fit in. And it's kind of sad that that's still around today.
Well, it's easy to find a lot of different lore in New England. I know that's where you live and talking to us today from. But as we know, lore exists everywhere. And you even did a podcast episode called Making a Mark, which featured stories from North Carolina. And one of my favorite parts of that episode was the story on the Korra tree. A woman is accused of being a witch, and she mysteriously disappears from this tree that she's tied to. Right before she's supposed to be burned alive, this bolt of lightning hits the tree and she escapes. And the only thing left is her name carved into the tree, which people can still see on Hatteras Island today.
According to the locals who tell the tale to this day, Captain Blood approached the tree with a lit torch in his hand, ready to set fire to the wood and burn the witch and her familiar alive. But another captain, a local man named John Smith, held him back, asking instead for Korra's trial to go through the proper legal channels. Smith, you see, being a sane man, wanted to do things right. But as the men argued, two things happened. First, the child in Korra's arms twisted and writhed as it transformed into a large black cat with shimmering green eyes. Second, a dark, ominous cloud began to gather overhead in an otherwise cloudless sky. Both men cried out in horror, and then Captain Blood lunged forward with the torch to ignite the kindling. It was at that very moment that the cloud overhead rumbled, and a lightning bolt flashed down, striking the tree and blinding everyone around it. When the smoke cleared, the tree was empty. The ropes were still there, as was the pile of branches and firewood, but the woman and the cat were gone without a trace. Well, that's not true. There was one clue, but it's difficult to believe. There, etched by lightning into the bark of the old oak tree, were four clear letters, which spelled out one single word. C-O-R-A. Korra.
So my question is, when you're looking for good lores to tell, like, what's the formula? What makes one story stand out versus another one, since they're everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a formula, because it would make it easier for me moving forward. I've done, I think 72 comes out on the 30th of this month. And you go into these, every time I go into them, I think, well, I've done a lot of these. I should be able to do this pretty easy this time. And every time is a challenge, just because it's not as simple as finding a cool story. It's, does the story have room for historical context to come in and flesh things out? Does the story have a long enough drama that I can tell that particular tale for, you know, 10 or 15 minutes? And I have to hold a lot of these ideas that I get up to that lens and use my intuition to say, you know, does this fit or not? And most of the time, I get the guess right. And, you know, there's been a couple times where I've started out and then I've said, you know, this actually doesn't work. And I've had to walk away. But for the most part, trusting my gut, I can narrow it down. But there is no formula that I've been able to discern other than, can this tale, can it entertain? You know, and can it entertain for the amount of time I need it to?
Well, and you've done podcasting now, you've written books, and now you have a new exciting project involving the producers from The Walking Dead, where you've made a TV show of lore that's available on Amazon. Why did you want to explore that medium?
My love is story, and I'll take it anywhere I can get it. You know, I'll read graphic novels or watch TV shows or movies. Podcasts are great, and you know, picking up a book is great. I love story any way I can get it. But what I've learned over the years is that some people gravitate toward certain particular media types. And so TV watchers, there's a large percentage of them that just don't listen to podcasts or read books. And you can say the same for readers, that they're just so in love with the physical book in their hands that they don't watch a lot of TV or listen to podcasts. There's overlap. There's always overlap. But what I wanted to do is make sure that I got good story out to people who love good story anywhere I could go. You know, so it's not so much about, you know, expanding an empire or some sort of, you know, get rich quick scheme. It's more about, if there are people that love these kinds of stories that will never pick up a podcast, you know, there are certain generations that just won't do that, or that are not on a streaming platform for TV, then I need to go where they're at. And so the TV show and the book series allow me to, you know, spread lore around a little bit better and just help the stories go places. It's also really cool when I bump into somebody. This happened on book tour last week, where I was in Portland and I'd mentioned a lighthouse story in Portland years ago. And this person remembered me mentioning that story and said, you know, that's a local legend and most people in the world don't even know it, but you took it and turned it into something global and let lots of other people hear it. And it wasn't my goal, you know, it wasn't to let me go find the obscure things and share them with people. But at the same time, there's something really enjoyable about being able to say, here are stories from all over and we can all enjoy them. So that's my goal at the end of the day. Let me just share a story in as many places as I can.
And that's great. I mean, I remember when you announced on the podcast that you were going to be doing this new project, but you reassured people, you're like, don't worry, the podcast is not going anywhere. And I think, yeah. I mean, I was like, oh gosh, I hope that the podcast isn't going anywhere, because it is such an intimate form of storytelling. It is just you kind of just like whispering in someone's ear this really interesting, unique story that they don't hear anywhere else. So I'm glad that you've been able to kind of hold on to both of those worlds.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, the good thing about what I do is that everything starts with writing, and then that's the trunk of the tree. And then all the different media forms are just branches that come off of it. So I record that written form for audio, and that's the podcast. I hand that written thing to the producers and the writers for the TV show, and we adapt it for TV, or I, you know, put that into a manuscript and I add and I curate for the books. And so everything starts with the one act of writing, and that's pretty satisfying. You know, at the end of the day, I'm a writer. That's what I do.
What scares you?
I have some of the typical fears that a lot of people have. I don't like open water, which is ironic. I live near the ocean, but I don't like to get past a harbor. It just feels weird. And then the fear of being buried alive, right? That's just that. It's kind of a good mix of everything. It's got fear of the dark, fear of small spaces, and you know, fear of death.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I know that your father, I don't know how old your children are, but I was wondering if they're grown or, you know, you're not reading stories to them. What kind of stories did you read to them when they were little growing up?
Well, so my kids are little. They're actually not old enough yet to the point where we're letting them experience lore. It's just a little beyond where we feel. And, you know, and that's something that it's interesting. I never set out and said, I'm going to have a filter in my head that limits the content. You know, that you can go find shows on podcast networks that have really deep, you know, fascinations with gore and violence, and you know, that's fine. Some people like that and they think that enhances the story, but I wanted to let the story itself, the narrative, be more of the star than the shock.
Well, and as a culture, it seems like we are kind of craving more of these scary horror stories. I mean, around this time of year, of course, but just in general with things from shows like The Walking Dead to podcasts like Lore, why do you think people enjoy being a little scared?
Well, you know, again, this comes back to me being an armchair psychologist more than anything, but I think part of it just has to do with the emotions you feel when you're afraid are so different than what you feel during your normal day. You know, the rush of adrenaline, you know, the increased heart rate, that little tingle. I think today we live in such a distraction-filled, isolated world, you know, where we're connected to everyone around the globe through social media, but at the same time, we're more alone than we ever were. I think we don't feel as much as we used to. And scary things have a way of bringing the feeling right back, and that might be part of it. Plus, the stuff I talked about earlier, with just with this love of the unknown. You know, we're in a modern world that's kind of chased away all the shadows. You know, with modern medicine and technology, and because you can know everything with a few taps on your phone, there aren't a lot of questions left, and I think that can make people feel like they're a little lost in the sea. And entertaining the shadows is powerful. I think it grounds us a little bit. It's okay to say, I don't know, you know, to hear these stories and say, what in the world was that? Well, I don't know. And I think that for a long time, we've been afraid to say, I don't know, because it sounds weak, but we just don't know sometimes.
And I've heard you say before that people really haven't changed all that much in 300 years. We're still making the same mistakes, still doing the same horrible things and kind of repeating history over and over again. So besides people getting like a little thrill or that feeling of being scared and all the emotions that come up with that, what do you hope people take away when they listen to the podcast or the TV show or read one of the books?
I think it's very frightening how people can use beliefs, fear, and hatred to give themselves permission to do things that are outside the realm of common sense. And it's something that's happened for centuries. It's just kind of taken on different forms as we've gone along. But this idea of the other is what pops up so often in these stories. Sometimes the other is a monster that's been invented by a culture because they need someone to blame for their own mistakes. You know, I've heard it said some anthropologists think that when the Vikings arrived in Iceland and there was nobody there to conquer, they just had a continent available to them, that they actually invented this idea of the elves because they needed someone to kind of point a finger at and tell stories about. And to this day, 53% of the people in Iceland believe in elves. And I think that there's a little bit of that going on in every generation where we point to the other and we cast our frustrations and blames on them, whether that other is, for a while it was women, for a while it was people of a different skin color or somebody who's outside of our culture, or maybe they're not as religious as us. It's taken on so many different forms. That's the part that I think is the most frightening, is that, we haven't given it up. We just, today in 2017, we've just picked a different group of others to focus on, and we still do it in some way, shape, or form.
So you're going to be coming to Charlotte in November, November 2nd. What can people expect by a live show of Lore?
Well, so it's me and Chad Lawson, who is a number one Billboard classical pianist. He's from the Charlotte area. He writes a lot of the music, and he's on tour with me whenever we do this. And so it's me and Chad on stage. Chad's got a piano, and I've got a book of tales, and it's about 90 minutes long. There's a theme to it. I walk people through some stories. It's a lot of rare or unheard material that you can't get on the podcast. Obviously, those nights always wrap up with some time with fans afterwards, talking about favorite episodes and getting to shake hands. So it's a good time.
That's Aaron Mankey speaking with WFAE's Sarah D'Elia. He's the creator, producer, and host of the podcast Lore, which has now been made into a television show on Amazon. He's also the author of the World of Lore book series. The Lore Live Tour with Aaron Mankey and musical guest Chad Lawson is rolling through Charlotte this Thursday, November the 2nd at 8 p.m. at the Dale Halton Theater on CPCC Central Campus. You can get more details about that and the Lore series at wfae.org/charlottetalks. I'm Mike Collins.